Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Robin Young, it's Here and Now. A leaked memo reveals that the government lawyers in a trial against the tobacco industry were overruled by senior Justice Department officials who ordered the lawyers to slash the penalties sought from the companies by $120 billion. Last week, as lawyers made their closing arguments in the case against the cigarette giants, they startled many, including the judge, when they announced they were slashing the penalties they were seeking from $130 billion to $10 billion. The judge went so far as to speculate out loud that outside influences may have led to that decision. Eric Lischblau of the New York Times joins us now on the line from Washington. Eric, could you start with an overview of this five-year trial involving the tobacco industry?
Sure. This is really the biggest civil racketeering trial in U.S. history. The Justice Department, in a case that started under President Clinton and Janet Reno, is trying to show that the tobacco industry basically engaged in a 50-year pattern of fraud and racketeering through deceptive advertising, luring teenagers into smoking, things like that. And the trial just concluded, as you said, last week after a 9-month trial that included testimony from dozens and dozens of health experts and industry types.
And how did the trial conclude?
Well, it's now in the judge's hands.
And now you've received this internal memo from May 30th. What does that memo tell you?
Well, it tells us for the first time that the lawyers who were arguing the case were dead set against this. They had argued vehemently against slashing the proposed penalty. And there were weeks and weeks of internal debate and dissension that got pretty acrimonious, and the trial lawyers felt as if the senior Justice Department officials who made the decision had essentially undermined their case. And they also say it'll send a message that private companies are able to profit from wrongful conduct.
The memo was written to Associate Attorney General Robert D. McCollum. What was his role in this?
Well, McCollum is the third ranking official at the Justice Department. He's very politically well-connected, a close friend of President Bush from their days at Yale together. He oversees the civil division and the tobacco trial team, and he made the final call to slash the award.
Can you explain the rationale of Robert McCollum in asking for the monies to be slashed?
Well, McCollum was pointing to an appellate court decision in February that found that any damages would have to be forward-looking, in the court's words, meaning that they would have to be aimed at stopping wrongful conduct in the future. Now, the trial lawyers said, we think $130 billion can be justified, and they put on a health expert to say that would be the cost of a stop smoking program for the next 25 years, which would help millions of people quit smoking and would cost $130 billion. McCollum had a more limited view of what the remedies in the case should be and believed that the much lower figure, $10 billion, was more reasonable to ask for.
And sufficient.
The trial lawyers in this memo that we wrote about today clearly were skeptical that this was the real reason, and they said that it would be seen as a politically driven decision that was not in any way based in the law and the facts of the case.
In part because Mr. McCollum was a partner in the Atlanta law firm Alston & Byrd, as you write, that's done legal work for R.J. Reynolds Tobacco, which is part of Reynolds American, which is a defendant in the case.
Right. The Justice Department lawyers writing the memo, in fairness, did not provide any direct evidence that the decision was politically motivated, but they said it would certainly seem that way. Other outside critics, anti-smoking advocates, Democrats, have certainly raised the connections between Mr. McCollum and his old firm and the tobacco industry, as well as the fact that that Big Tobacco is a big contributor to the Republican Party, gave about $2.7 million last year.
We understand that Democratic congressmen have protested the decision to slash the penalties requested from $130 billion to $10 billion. Eric Lischblau, what happens now?
Well, I would think that the protests are going to accelerate now with the disclosure that lawyers inside the government, the ones who have been working this case for 5 years, had objected so strenuously to this decision, and some of them were even threatening to quit. Already, even before this, in the last week, we've had a whole round of protests from Democrats and health advocates and others. Those led earlier this week to the Justice Department opening an internal ethics investigation. Then there was another round of protests on Wednesday with about 50 Democratic congressmen and senators urging the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, not to settle the case. Now we'll see from here with this new disclosure that all is likely to intensify.
Eric Lischblau is legal affairs correspondent for The New York Times. Eric, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Democrats in Congress are holding a hearing today on recently revealed top-secret memos from Britain that indicate that as early as 2002, President Bush was bent on war in Iraq, even though in the run-up to the war, 8 months later, he and his administration publicly stated war was a last option. The memos reveal what was said in two briefings between Prime Minister Tony Blair and his aides in July of 2002, after British intelligence officials met with U.S. officials. One memo says it, quote, seemed clear that Bush had made up his mind to take military action and that the White House had, quote, fixed intelligence data to justify the war. Another memo concludes the U.S. was inadequately planning for post-war occupation. These so-called Downing Street memos caused a fury overseas when the first was reported in British newspapers on May 1st, but hardly a murmur here until online bloggers demanded greater attention. Well, joining us first on the line from Washington is Todd Purdom, a New York Times correspondent, who recently wrote an article reviewing the two memos. And Todd, you say the documents are not quite so shocking. Why?
Well, because if you were reading the newspapers in either London or Washington in the summer of 2002, you had a really good sense that, as the one Downing Street memo puts it, war was inevitable. True, the White House and President Bush himself, Prime Minister Blair, were not saying that in public, but they were leaning very heavily into military planning. The papers were full of reports about detailed war plans. The consensus on Capitol Hill was that things were moving very strongly in that direction. Colin Powell was warning publicly and privately of the dangers of a prolonged potential occupation of Iraq, how complicated it would be. So this is not completely shocking that there was a strong sense that the Bush administration was headed to war.
Strong sense is one thing, but isn't it shocking that a memo documents that military action was seen as inevitable by the Bush administration in 2002, but in the run-up to war in 2003, President Bush, same man, told the American public that this was the last option. Isn't that, as Eric Bollert writes in Salon.com, a president lying to his people?
I think lying is a relative term depending on where you sit. I hate to sound like, you know, Bill Clinton or someone, but I think what is shocking and dramatic about the memo is that it is a memo. It's a top secret memo written by our closest ally. It has James Bond-like language about, you know, see, the intelligence chief has returned. But after all, what this person is reporting is merely his own impressionistic sense that war was inevitable. He doesn't put that phrase in anyone's mouth. He doesn't say that's what Condoleezza Rice told him. He doesn't say that's what Secretary Rumsfeld told him. He said that's what it felt like to him in the summer of 2002 in Washington. And I can say I was here in Washington in the summer of 2002 covering the State Department, and that's what it felt like to me.
But it's another thing to be inside these rooms, as this British operative was. But what about other aspects of the memo? The line, the intelligence and facts being fixed around the policy.
Well, obviously we know that there were many flaws in pre-war intelligence, and plenty of people have concluded that if we knew then what we know now about how thinly sourced some of this material was about Iraq's weapons programs, the debate in Congress would have played out very differently, and that's totally true. There is an interesting side controversy, however, about whether that word fixed is used in the British Oxford English Dictionary sense of attached to, connected to, as opposed to the 1919 World Series being fixed or crooked up or... Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of contextual evidence that the writer meant that the intelligence would be attached to the policy, and that's another way of saying what Paul Wolfowitz later said, which was that WMD was chosen as the most saleable means of persuading allies and reluctant Congress and a reluctant British Parliament to support the use of force if necessary. So I'm not saying that there's nothing sort of really tantalizing and exciting about these memos. There is, and that's why the mainstream media has addressed them, perhaps belatedly, in the face of some rather sharp criticism from the blogosphere, especially the liberal blogosphere, that the mainstream media was not quick enough to pounce on these memos after the Times of London revealed the first one last month. But one of the problems, one of the conventions of mainstream journalism, is that during the summer of 2002, these memos reflect in a very direct way is you'd have to be a moron to think we weren't headed to war. I think you can go back to that summer and find untold examples of the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times and NPR and other outlets making it clear that President Bush, whether he would acknowledge it or not, was bent on going to war.
In fact, take us back to some of that pre-war reporting. I'm thinking of the Time magazine item in March of 2003 that tells of an incident the year before, March 2002, in which President Bush poked his head into a meeting between Condoleezza Rice and three U.S. senators and said, F. Saddam, using the full expletive, we're taking him out. You had heard this.
Yeah, and there's another incident that Richard Haass told Nick Lemon in The New Yorker just as the war was getting underway, that in July 2002, he was at that time the State Department's policy planning director. He'd gone to see Condoleezza Rice to ask if it really made sense to try to put Iraq on the front burner at a time that the United States was engaged in the global war on terrorism, and he said that she said, save your breath, that decision's been made. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a complicated reality, and I think, Robin, what makes it so painful for people, especially people who opposed the war, is that if a secret memo had been circulating in public in the fall of 2002 when Congress was getting ready to vote on this, it would have caused a huge stir, and maybe the outcome would have been different. What would have really made the outcome different is if everyone had known that there would be no weapons of mass destruction, if everyone had known how terribly the post-war period would go and how difficult the occupation and the insurgency would be. I think a lot of people who voted for the resolution might not have voted for it.
Well, Todd Purdom, one last question. I'm wondering if you also might think that the value of the memos now, in today, is that not everyone was reading the New York Times or Time magazine in 2002, 2003. Not every American can follow every tick. They have lives to lead. And that they are valuable now in that they are not rumor, they're not speculation, they seem to be fact from a meeting between British leaders and American leaders.
I think the memos are really valuable because they're part of the historical record. We don't have too many documents like this so far from our side. Eventually, someday, we presumably will. And they're like pieces of a puzzle. They may not be, you know, solving the secret of the Sphinx, but they round out the picture in a very meaningful way, and it's worth paying attention to them.
President Bush and Tony Blair both brushed off these memos when they were asked about them at their recent meeting. Do they also, though, tell us that there was no debate about the war? What do you think they finally tell us? Because the Bush administration, of course, said that in the run-up to war, there was much internal debate. Which do you believe? Was there or wasn't there?
I think they tell us, actually, that there was quite a lot of internal debate, because one of the things that, from the British side, the memos seem to emphasize most of all is how important it was from Prime Minister Blair's perspective to get the United States to focus on things like what the day after in Iraq would look like, how you could make an international case under international law that Saddam Hussein was in violation of UN resolutions. So it's clear that part of what these memos reflect is Britain's intense determination to mold and shape the war planning and the possible diplomacy that could have averted war in order to build a case for going to war. That comes through overwhelmingly, and it shows that the Bush administration, even though it wasn't very happy about it sometimes, was paying attention to Tony Blair, just as it was paying attention to Secretary of State Colin Powell, and I think that the memos reflect that.
Todd Purdom, correspondent for The New York Times. Well, as we said, members of Congress are considering the memos today, and when we return, we'll check in with Eric Boehlert of Salon.com, who, as we said, has a very different take on the importance of the Downing Street memos. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now, and we've been looking at the so-called Downing Street memos, which indicate that in 2002, President Bush was planning for war in Iraq, even though he said that he didn't decide to go to war until shortly before the bombing began in March of 2003. The memos reveal that in July of 2002, British Prime Minister Tony Blair and his aides, after meeting with Bush administration officials, thought that a U.S.-led war was inevitable. The documents have made headlines around the world, but less so in the U.S. Democrats in Congress are holding a hearing today and are demanding an explanation from the administration. And joining us on the line now is Eric Boehlert. He's senior writer for Salon.com, one of the first online journalists to call attention to this story. And Eric, I mentioned some of your thoughts when we talked with Todd Purdom of The New York Times, but let's get them directly from you. Do you agree with Todd that there is nothing shocking in these memos, that there was plenty of reporting about the certainty of war before the war started?
Well, I mean, I think Todd's right in the sense that people were paying attention, and people who thought about these things thought, you know, once, I mean, Bush and Rumsfeld started sending fleets in the fall of 2002, there was going to be a war. But that's not the point here. The point as you heard Todd talk, I mean, the press has overthought this memo to death, and I think after 5 weeks of trying to justify why they didn't write about it, you heard some of the sort of extraordinary complex reasons he came up with. It made headlines in every other country in the world, and yet for some reason there was this groupthink among American editors, writers, and producers. They all came to the same conclusion, which was, this is not news, which is just amazing.
Well, Michael Kinsley of the L.A. Times also writes, I don't buy the fuss. He points out that the memo is essentially one man's perception. As you write, the man is Sir Richard Dearlove, the head of the British Secret Intelligence Service. He became known as C in the memo. And he writes, there was a perceptible shift. In other words, his perception, a military action was now seen as inevitable. He doesn't quote any administration officials. There are no words in the mouth of anyone from Washington.
Right, but come on. I mean, this is minutes from a meeting of about a dozen of Blair's closest advisors. The head of his intelligence comes back from a trip where he met with the head of the CIA and said there's been a shift in Washington. They're going to war. I mean, that's news. The fact that they wanted to use the UN as sort of a charade to prompt a war, both memos go into this in great detail, that is news. All of this is news. Up and down the line, it's news. You know, you can argue that, yes, it's secondhand. You can argue it doesn't prove anything. You could dismiss the critics on the strident critics on the left who say this is grounds for impeachment. But you can't sit there and say this is not news. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is news, and they have, and people who ignored it now are coming up with rather elaborate justifications. I sort of admire the Associated Press, and they admit we dropped the ball. We should have written about this.
Eric Bollert. You cite a TV survey group called TV Eyes, yeah, as to how many stories were done on the memos. What was the information you found?
I came up with in 5 weeks, all the networks, all the cable television channels, which of course are doing 24 hours, approximately 20 mentions between May 1st and June 6th before Blair came to town. That's, you know, probably 900 hours worth of programming, 20 mentions.
As opposed to the coverage, let's say, of Saddam Hussein in his underwear.
About 300 mentions.
Yeah. Well, what do you think, though, of the sense that we have, as you've been saying, we have heard this all before? You don't think many Americans share that? Because, in fact, when the memos were reported on, we reported on them on this program, they were met in some ways with a big yawn. And you know, others have written that. Of course, there's the blogosphere and many on the left completely exercised over these memos, but not mainstream America. Why?
Well, mainstream America was never really told about the memos. It's not up to reporters and editors and producers to decide, gee, here's a piece of news. Will Americans really be interested in this? You're overthinking these things. When a document like this is leaked and it makes headlines in Britain and it has to do with America's decision to go to war, you report it. You don't think about, gosh, you know, I already knew we were going to war and people at the State Department knew that. You just report it. What the bigger problem is just sort of this groupthink that has sort of set in, I think, in the Washington Press Corps, which it was fascinating that, you know, television, magazines, newspapers, they all saw this, and they all came, virtually everyone came to the same conclusion, which was this isn't news. And yet news organizations in virtually every other country of the world thought it was news. So, I mean, I think it's more troubling in what it says about the press not wanting to go back and talk about the war, not wanting to go back and talk about the run-up, which I think they performed very poorly, and this sort of this notion that, well, let's just move on, and we don't want to, we, like the Bush administration, don't want to talk about this, and we're not that interested in it.
You are writing primarily about the press, but I guess I'm asking, what do you think should happen, you know, to the administration as a result of this? I mean, and is the discussion about how the press covered this distracting from what the memos actually say?
Well, in a way it is, but I think you have to have the first, you have to have one before the other. I mean, if people online and people like Salon and other bloggers hadn't made a fuss, we wouldn't be talking about this. So the first step is to sort of shame the press into acknowledging this, and we're seeing more and more stories, and then the American people can decide for themselves. And I think with each reassessment, they're becoming increasingly sour, and they can take the information about the memo into account when they make their opinions on it.
We do want to point out that Jeffrey Dvorkin, who's ombudsman for National Public Radio, agrees with you. He says the memo deserves more attention, and it's a bigger story than we've given it. So, Eric, Congress begins informational hearings on the memos and what they say. What do you think, where do you think that line of questioning will go?
Back to the summer of 2002 and the fall of 2002, when President Bush at almost every public opportunity was saying war was the last option. And that's, you know, it's the most serious decision the president and administration can make. And there continues to be very serious questions about how that decision was made and about how truthful they were being with the American people and with Congress.
Do you think President Bush lied to the American people?
Oh, I do, yeah. No question.
Eric Bollert, senior writer for Salon.com. Eric, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, now it's your chance. We've heard from lots of you on this issue, and we'd like to hear more. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And tomorrow on Here and Now, the Detroit Pistons making a comeback. Can the city of Detroit do the same? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The new book, All Those Mornings at the Post, The 20th Century in Sports, from famed Washington Post columnist Shirley Povich, is the ultimate family affair. Lynn Povich, David Povich, and TV talk show host Maury Povich are all listed as editors of the book, which is made up of their father Shirley's columns. Maury Povich spoke with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, who asked him first, what was it like to edit the collection with your siblings?
Well, it was interesting. My brother is one of the great trial lawyers in the country at Williams & Connolly in Washington, and he basically took the view of, Maury, you and Lynn do it, and I'll look it over. And since my sister is kind of semi-retired, she went through all of my father's columns from 1924 until 1998, which means that she probably read somewhere in the neighborhood of 15,000 columns. I mean, this was an entire view of 20th century sports, and in that regard, because sports was so much part of the social fabric, it was part of domestic history in this country during that time. And what we found was that my father had much more of a social conscience than we ever imagined. I mean, he was writing about integrating baseball in the 1930s when no other white sports writer would ever take on that task. And he wrote a lot about the Olympics. He did not like Avery Brundage, even from the 1936 Olympics on, when he was the United States Olympic Committee chairman, and all the way through 1972, and he thought that Brundage kind of really threw away the whole meaning and the whole tragedy that happened in Munich. Mm-hmm. We found out that he was just a marvelous writer, and sports was his venue, but indeed he was right there with all the great columnists of the 20th century.
You know, it's interesting to me that you bring up right at the top his integrity, because it does shine through in a great many columns, but that integrity had a kind of a flip side, too. I understand that when Tom Shales wrote a column criticizing your TV show, Shirley was unsympathetic to your complaints.
Well, he surely was. It was one of those things where, you know, my father did indeed love us and loved us dearly, but, you know, he was very pragmatic. And one time, Tom Shales, the Pulitzer Prize-winning TV critic of the Post, I mean, he just nailed me, blasted me unmercifully in the paper one day. He used every S word in the world. It was back when I was doing A Current Affair, and he called me smarmy and sordid and all these S words. And I called up Dad, and I said, Dad, don't let Mom read this column today, because, I mean, Shales really, he just took me on and killed me. And he said, well, don't worry about that, son. Go about your business. I said, no, you don't understand, Dad. I mean, he killed me. He says, well, you know, I helped to hire him at the Washington Post. And I said, Dad, I'm your son. He says, yeah, but good writers are hard to find.
Your father wrote columns for the Post, as you say, for 75 years, many of them terrific columns. But still, do you ever remember a morning when you heard him say, gee, I wish I didn't have to write today?
Well, his blood brother was Red Smith, and they were just great companions together. And they felt the same way every single morning. They were scared. Every morning they woke up, and they went to their typewriter, and they suffered from snow blindness. Mm. They didn't know what to do. You have to understand, back in these days, they were writing six columns a week, plus covering all the events. I mean, there was a time in the 1930s and 40s and early 50s, my father covered the Washington Senators baseball team. He wrote every game story. He wrote every sidebar story. And he wrote six columns a week. He did give me one piece of advice. He says, if you're really unsure of yourself and you don't know what to do that day, take on a subject that everybody knows about. In other words, don't go small. Write about somebody everybody knows about. So for all those budding sports writers, I would say the same thing.
Now, I've read that your sister, when she was growing up, complained that some of the boys who asked her out did so just so they could come into your living room and talk sports with Shirley. Did having a famous sports columnist for a dad present any problems for you?
Not for me. I mean, that's the difference, I guess, about being a girl and being a boy and growing up in that family in the 1940s and 50s. I mean, I and my brother, my older brother, I mean, we had the greatest life of all. We were bat boys for the baseball team in spring training. We were at my father's knee. We had no heroes. I mean, Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams would always say, there goes Shirley's kid. I mean, those were just days of glory for us. I mean, it was back in the days when I guess maybe because I'm getting older, I look back and I think that, you know, the days were bright and the nights were clear and so were our minds.
All right, it's almost Father's Day weekend. How do you remember your dad as a father as opposed to as a famous sports writer who gave you all these ins?
He was the kind of parent that was kind of omnipresent even though he wasn't there a lot. When they went on baseball trips in my, you know, preteen days and teenage days, they would be gone for 3 weeks because when you cover the baseball teams back then, you went on that Western swing, which back then was St. Louis and Chicago and Detroit and Cleveland, and there were 3 week road trips on trains. And so my mother basically raised us, and you know, she always used to say, you know, everything in this family is about your father, and you guys go around adoring your father, and I feel that you're all motherless children. And in fact, she's the one who raised us. But he always had a presence there. You know, he was a New Englander. I mean, he was, you know, very slow to show emotion, but there was always this overwhelming sense of love. He grew up in a family that had come over from Russia, and he was a first-generation American. And his he used to tell me about his parents, who loved this country so dearly. It was a very observant Jewish home up there in Bar Harbor, Maine. But mm-hmm. He said it was so thrilling to be in America that he was 15 years old before he realized that Thanksgiving was not a Jewish holiday.
There are, of course, lots of writers and columnists, sports and otherwise, who have said that they've learned from your father's work. Besides Red Smith, who you have identified as his colleague, of course, who were the younger writers that he particularly admired as he went along?
He loved Jim Murray. Jim Murray felt like he was my father's younger brother. Mm-hmm. Today, I mean, for instance, he would love George Vesey. He loved Michael Wilbon and Tony Kornheiser. And Tom Boswell of the Washington Post. But here's what's happened in sports writing. So many of the good sports writers are now on television. So it's very difficult to kind of split your world, to be able to sit back and write and have such a great style and at the same time go on television. Mm. So what happens today is that many of those sports writers who go on television, they talk their columns on the air. So when they come to their writing their columns, it sounds like they're still on television. So I think in a way, in an effort to gain income, and who can deny that, I think they give up some of their style today. And the writers who still write, you know, the Roger Angels of the New Yorker and George Vesey of the New York Times, who rarely goes on television, and Tom Boswell, who rarely goes on television, those are the writers who've been able to retain their great styles.
Maury Povich speaking with Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game about the new anthology of sports columns by his father, the late, great Shirley Povich. Well, still to come, born in Ukraine with gypsy roots, now an actor and a punk rocker in the U.S., get ready for Eugene Hutz of the band Gogol Bordello. You're listening to Here and Now. Pharmacists around the country are wrestling with a dilemma. How do you remain loyal to your religion, which may prohibit the use of birth control, for example? Some doctors, nurses, and pharmacists are solving that dilemma by refusing care they don't agree with. Alta Sharo is professor of law and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin Law School. She wrote a piece on the subject, which appears today in the New England Journal of Medicine. Producer Rachel Gottbaum spoke with Sharo for the journal's online edition and asked her to give examples of medical professionals refusing care due to religious beliefs.
Let me start with an example involving a pharmacist here in Wisconsin. This pharmacist refused to fill a birth control prescription that was brought to him on a weekend by a woman who was already on the last day of her existing pill pack. The pharmacist not only refused to fill the prescription, but he refused to give the prescription back to this woman so that she could find another pharmacy to fill it for her. His statement to the pharmacy board here in Wisconsin was that he felt that in any way facilitating her ability to obtain birth control pills represented facilitating abortion. We also have examples in Wisconsin of refusals to fill prescriptions for emergency contraception. In that case, the woman was unable to obtain that in time, and she did in fact become pregnant and subsequently had to have a first trimester abortion.
Is this behavior among these healthcare professionals legal?
It depends upon the state that you're in. What we are seeing is a pattern of bill introductions across the United States that would statutorily protect professionals who refuse to provide these services.
This is a recent trend. Why is this coming up now?
I think it's coming up now because of two things very closely intersecting. One is, as patients demand more autonomy, so do their physicians. And second, we are at a moment of profound debate about the role of religion in our individual, professional, and public lives, and a moment at which the political forces organized around religions have become particularly powerful, so that religion becomes the way in which some professionals now express this greater entitlement to autonomy. They say, as a professional, if I'm obligated to either provide a service or refer for the service or even tell you about the service, it forces me to violate my own religious beliefs, and therefore it should be unconstitutional for the government to force me to provide these services.
In your view, is it ever justifiable for healthcare professionals to refuse to deliver medical care on the basis of personal beliefs?
Well, I do think that as a profession, there is absolutely a collective obligation to provide all medical services that are legally available and to provide them on a non-discriminatory basis. That said, if collectively a group of professionals, whether it's the group of pharmacists at a particular drugstore or it's the group of physicians in an OBGYN practice at a local hospital, are capable of ensuring that collectively they can give every patient every service to which he or she is entitled. If within that little group they are willing to agree that one doctor doesn't have to do certain things that another doctor does, that is unobjectionable. What is not acceptable is the idea that as a profession, the profession can act as super legislators and essentially decide which services will be, in fact, available to patients and which will not.
So what's going to be the outcome of this?
Well, one interesting outcome that's already emerging is a set of bills that attempt to counter the trend. In Illinois, we had a governor's order that pharmacies, not pharmacists, but pharmacies, must provide all legally written prescriptions to their patients. And if the pharmacy can figure out a way to let some pharmacists recuse themselves, that's fine, but the pharmacy has the obligation. And in the United States Senate, Senator Santorum and Senator Kerry have joined to introduce legislation concerning religious freedom that would essentially allow acts of religious conscience only to the extent that they do not prevent patients from obtaining legally prescribed medicines or services. So we're now beginning to see the battle lines drawn with different kinds of legislation at the federal and state level, both being debated at the same time.
Professor Alta Sharo's essay on ethics appears in this week's New England Journal of Medicine. She spoke with reporter Rachel Gottbaum. For a link to the article, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Eugene Hutz is a name you may not know now, but we think you soon will. He was born in Ukraine in 1972. As a child, he heard the band Sonic Youth and knew that someday he would live in New York City and play punk rock. Well, after Chernobyl blew, Eugene fled with his family, moving through refugee camps just as his nomadic gypsy ancestors had once crossed Russia. When he arrived in New York City, he became a trend-setting fashion model. He's branched into acting. Eugene Hutz has been cast as Alex, the wacky Ukrainian interpreter in the film version of Jonathan Safran Foer's smash bestseller, Everything is Illuminated. And he is touring with the band of his childhood dreams, Gogol Bordello, quite possibly the only international gypsy-slash-punk rock band out there.
And my wedding was about to start. Dogs were barking, monkeys clapping. Then I got up on table and I said, I meet you 10:45 on the Broadway canal. Disco radical transglobal.
And Eugene Hutz joins us in the studio. Welcome.
How you doing? How are you?
I'm fine. What did punk mean to you? I said you saw Sonic Youth when you were in Ukraine.
Yeah, back when they were in their prime, yes.
And when you fled Ukraine, in fact, the first thing you tried to decide was how many of my bootleg albums can I get out, you know, before the Chernobyl wave comes over me. I mean, this has obviously been important to you. What did punk mean to you?
It meant liberation and change, as it had meant that to many, many people across many, many countries. It's the only thing it can mean. It's basically getting up and doing something out for yourself despite all this garbage that system feeds to you since you're born. Mm. And the thing is that it was even double-powered by the fact that it was in perestroika time, where in the late 80s, the whole country was embraced in the social change and reformation. Whether people liked it or not, the change was on the corner.
And what you're adding to it now is this gypsy flavor. You have gypsy ancestors. What does that music say to you?
I think that music is particularly of Russian and Ukrainian Roma, which is Roma, which is correct word for the gypsy, mm-hmm. is more of a...
By the way, I have to ask, are you offended if I say gypsy? Is that offensive?
No.
Okay.
Well, it's been so... You know, I'd rather have that word out there so people at least start getting interested in what it actually is, then educate them about actual words, then just say Roma and then have people thinking that it means Italian or
right.
or Romanian, you know.
Yeah, right.
So since it's so widely accepted, I have to kind of work with that.
Okay.
But challenge that right after the reference, you know.
Well, what does it mean to you, Roma, gypsy?
I think most of all it's just kind of unifying factor for issues that concern me the most, which is music and human rights. The whole thing about Roma culture is that it's been so derogatory treated for so many centuries that it became a symbolic thing for violation of human rights, which just goes on left and right. And I just find it to be an extremely urgent issue.
In most of your songs, you express some sort of observation about some facet of human life. We're going to hear Avenue B. What's this about?
That song was kind of a result of this Russian party in New York that where so many people get so fired up discussing what Russian identity really is. And some of them claiming that Russian identity basically doesn't even exist, you know, because you can't identify something that takes over such a large territory. Mm. If you think about, like, tough, pushy guys, you know, who drink a lot and party, that's not even necessarily really Russian. But it's all about challenging what really stereotypes and just really making sure that people still go more for international mentality than anything, that they inherited with propaganda as far as national factors go.
Rather than stereotyping.
Yeah, I mean, this band is so international. Mm-hmm. It's a big anti-nationalistic statement.
Well, you and five of your international bandmates have brought your instruments here to our studios. They range from an accordion and a violin to your guitar, Eugene. Let's hear Avenue B from Gogol Bordello.
Bon, que estoy pañola, parsley!
ay, 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 ah, woo, woo, woo. Ay, 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 not me, not you. Ay, 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 ah, woo, woo, woo. Ay, 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 not me, not you.
Sitting in a Russian bathhouse on the Avenue B. No matter how much we sweat, we just can't agree. Я разыгрываю, как проводим мы. Nobody learned no nothing from an old history.
That was the band Go Go Bordello playing Avenue B off their new CD. And Eugene, I can't let you go without asking about your film experience. You know, people have been coming to the studio and seeing you, and they're like, in New York, he's a superstar. I mean, I remember the articles about your fashion model experience, right?
Uh-huh.
When you have this mustache that spans your whole face there.
Well, it's the usual, you know. I've had it for 7 years.
I know, but everyone thought it was this big fashion statement.
Well, that describes how foolish this fashion business is, because, you know, it's simply how my whole family looks, and it's how my uncle looks and my father looks, and it was hilarious. We were cracking up with the whole family.
From there, you go to talk to the director of the film version of Jonathan Safran Foer's bestseller, Everything is Illuminated.
Uh-huh.
You talk to him about perhaps doing some music, and the next thing you know, you are cast as perhaps one of the great characters in literature in a long time, Alex, the Ukrainian.
He's definitely a fun character, yes.
Alex, for those who hadn't read the book, he's a very self-assured interpreter who just mangles the English language.
Yes.
How do you feel about him?
Well, I love mangling English myself. And now that I'm speaking it pretty much fluently, I'm kind of starting to miss times when I was writing God knows what and getting up on stage and actually not even knowing what the hell I'm really singing. So I'm kind of like due to move on to some other language as far as that treat goes.
You could probably...
Maybe Spanish will be my
so
next
So you can continue
stop.
To mangle.
Well, another thing is that when I was growing up in Ukraine, I was surrounded by characters like that. I mean, it's anti-biographical character for me, and that's what I loved about it, because on stage... And with Gogol Bordello, I control my whole work. And so here I was working with control from somewhere else too, which is, you know, a challenge I kind of already was ready for.
Eugene Hutz with his band Gogol Bordello have been visiting us in the studio. It's a pleasure to meet you, and we really look forward to more from you.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me and putting up with us.
For more information on Gogol Bordello, go to our website, here-now.org.
It's the underdog outside. It's the underdog outside.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.